I didn't do podcasts, right? Like, I didn't talk to venture capitalists. I didn't go and like fill out Enterprise Ireland forms. All I did was...
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. This week, we have an incredibly special guest for you. I'm just sitting down with Owen Hinchey, the founder of Tynes. Tynes have grown from 5 people just before COVID to over 170 people all across the globe. They've also raised close to $100 million. This is a special entrepreneur and a special company. As he describes himself, he is building a generational company from right here in Dublin, and we discuss how he is doing that. This is my interview, Owen Hinchey, founder of Tynes.
Thanks to my partner, Square. Everything your business needs, like payments, menu management, online ordering, chatting endlessly about the weather. Well, you're on your own there. Square. Everything your business needs. Almost. Visit square.com.
Owen, welcome to the pod.
Thank you so much for having me, man.
It is such a privilege to have you here. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're too kind.
I knew you had had a wild journey, but only when you filled me in over lunch did I realize how wild it's been.
Hey, I didn't have lunch. I just had a coffee. You're the man who had lunch. Yeah, it has been wild. I think you don't really realize how wild it is until like you explain it to somebody else. And as you hear the words coming out of your own mouth, you're kind of like, geez, did we really do that? Like, was that actually happened? So yeah, it has been a little bit of a wild time. In a time of wildness, it was a wild time.
And it's funny when I get to sit down with people and kind of go, 2018, oh yeah, a lot's happened since then.
Yeah.
So like you only started in 2018, but that stat you told me of just before COVID, there was 5 of you.
Correct.
And now there's
160 something, 162.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is explosive. We'll get there, but we'll start back in 2018. So 2018, what were you doing?
2018, I was senior director of cybersecurity for DocuSign. So my background is in cybersecurity and software engineering. And I had joined DocuSign in 2014 to help them build and run their global cybersecurity team. And I had been doing that for probably about 4 years, I want to say, and was running a team of folks spread across the world. I think I had team members in like 5 different time zones, and they were all like incredible people, all knew their jobs inside out. And we were looking for a particular type of product, essentially an automation platform that would allow my teams who knew their jobs automate their own repetitive work. And over the course of about 6 months, we looked at tons of different products that we hoped we could buy to scratch that itch that we had. And none of them were like remotely suitable. Like we hated every single one of them, in fact. And so out of like sheer frustration, I was just like, you know what? I think I'm just going to go and do this myself. And I remember, because I had a really long notice period in DocuSign. And I remember talking to my boss, who's a friend of mine, in like kind of like mid-2017. That's how long my notice period was.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I was like, hey, look.
You locked in good. They valued you.
Yeah. I guess so.
Don't leave because I'll find you.
Yeah. And I remember talking to her. I was like, hey, look, I think I really want to do this. And she was like super supportive. I make this joke that she was probably a little bit too supportive, man. Like I probably should have read through the lines a little bit. She was like, yeah, go for it.
Oh, you want to leave? No problem.
Leave today.
You want to go now?
Yeah, exactly. And so... had decided to like do Tynes. And then, so in 2018, February 1st, 2018, my last day in DocuSign was January 31st, February 1st, 2018, founded Tynes. With no real idea of what I was going to do other than to build the product that I wished I could have bought when I worked in DocuSign. That was it. That was
a pretty clear mission though. Yeah.
Yeah.
You knew where you were going to. You just didn't know what was going to be in the middle.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. And I was, I also knew that I wasn't going to do it from home. So I got a tiny little office, not far from here in Rathmines. And I paid like 180 euros a month for like this tiny little office or tiny little hot desk in Rathmines. And just wrote code 12 hours a day, 7 days a week. And that's pretty much still what I do. 5 years later, write code. But like, that's...
Okay, we talked about this over lunch as well. That's like dog years. To you, it's probably like 50 years. But 2018 is not that long ago. So you've had it's been a serious rocket ship since then. So you started it off yourself. I love this, though. I think this is where the magic is. A small office, like one desk, 2018, just you. What was your first kind of landmark? Where were you heading towards in 2018? What did you want to achieve in that year?
So I'd given myself a year, and I'd agreed with my wife, hey, look, let's give this a year.
Okay.
If it doesn't work out, I'm going to be working unpaid. If it doesn't work out, I'll just go back and get a job, like working somewhere else. And maybe DocuSign would even have me back. So I had given it a year, and I had made the massive mistake of assuming that anyone gave a shit about what I was doing. I think that's one of the big realizations, is that you assume, hey, I'm doing this big, massive thing. Everybody's going to care about this. Everybody's going to want to know what I'm working on. They're going to want to see demos of the product. And all of a sudden you realize, actually, no one cares, could care less about what you're actually doing. So I wanted to get traction, like any kind of meaningful traction, whether that was like a customer, whether that was 100 customers. I really didn't know. I didn't know how much I should be charging for the product. I didn't know who our ICP was. I didn't even know what ICP stood for.
I was going to say ICP.
Ideal customer profile. So
perfect.
So when you're founding a company, you're trying to like find the narrowest group of people. You're trying to get as niche as you possibly can. And so your ICP, your ideal customer profile, is somebody who will buy your product today. Some people call it like realistic customer profile, etc. But like your ideal person, that if you found this person and they found your product, they would buy it. So I kind of had like an idea in my head of who that would be. And I wrote code nonstop, like a man possessed for like 3 months, like just nonstop building this product, and very much building it in such a way that I wanted it to scratch like my own itch.
Okay.
Now, I'm not a software engineer, right? I know enough to be dangerous. And as the professional software engineers in times will tell you, I am not a good software engineer, but I knew enough to kind of hack together this MVP.
Yeah.
So it would do what I wanted it to do. But I pretty much down tools. I stopped writing code after like 8 weeks. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to try and get people to look at this product and give me feedback.
Brilliant.
I think that as a founder, your only job is to get to product market fit. That's it. Everything else is secondary. And so I knew that I needed to have some sort of way to say that I had product market fit. And so I just went around to all my friends that I'd previously worked with, and I was like, hey, I've built this cool thing. Would you be interested in checking it out? A lot of them said yes. Some of them even agreed to like put it into like a demo or a bake-off situation. I just started to get like a little bit of traction, even though the product was so bare bones. Again, there's only 8 weeks of development by a single engineer, like, and not even a fully qualified engineer. So it was extraordinarily bare bones, but it had enough, it could show enough that people were like, actually, yeah, I see where this is going. I kind of like this.
That's crucial, though. I think a lot of founders miss that step. They code for like 8 months or 8 years, and I'll go, Will is perfect. I think that's a crucial insight for people to realize, though, the feedback.
Yeah.
Who's your customer?
It's all that matters, right? Like, it is literally all that matters. And I had known that was the case when I founded the company. So I was doing like demos of the product like after like 3 weeks, even though it was just like, man, this thing absolutely stinks and it doesn't work. And I'm like mocking a whole load of data here just to see what was resonating with people, what people cared about, what were some interesting use cases that I could like demonstrate later on and further down the road. So yeah, just getting that initial feedback. And eventually I got into a situation where a dude I had previously worked with was working for a big, big company. And he was like, actually, man, you know what? We're in the middle of starting an automation initiative, and we're going to be evaluating ServiceNow, who are like $100 billion company, Splunk, who are a $30 billion company. And would you guys like the third place? And I was like, yeah, that sounds good to me. So I found myself as a single person in this company, like in a bake-off against like, you know, two of the biggest enterprise companies like on the planet.
At what stage was this?
Summer 2018.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So pretty February to summer, like not long.
Yep. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
Okay. So you're you're in the mixer straight away.
Yeah. But it felt long. It felt like, man, why isn't aren't people buying this thing in April?
Wow.
Like, okay. Why aren't people buying this thing in May? Like it does what I say. and again, I think it was just down to the fact that people didn't really care, right? Like it's not as if like they're saying, oh, this is really cool. I see you've worked hard on this. Yeah. Let me have
well done.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give you like a charity trial. But yes, that's kind of how it got started.
I think it's beautiful because you knew exactly where you wanted to go, but there was no ego there in terms of you weren't so sure that you didn't go out and get feedback. I think that's crucial because it's like that Reid Hoffman quote, if you're not embarrassed by your first product, you've waited too long.
Yeah. Oh, I was mortified by it.
Yeah. But that's magic. But you didn't have enough of an ego where you weren't like, well, it has to be perfect because it represents me. I think that's a huge hole that people fall into all the time. They're nearly embarrassed to say it. They kind of want it to look good and perfect.
I would even say that like it goes beyond like the first version of the product. Like, so we've been developing product for like 5 years. We've got a team of extraordinarily talented designers and product people and engineers. And we still try and ship features before we think they're ready. Like every single time it's like, oh man, there's so much stuff here that's missing, but let's just get it out the door.
So was this first Bake Off, was that your first kind of landmark for you? Like, we're going here. There's something magic here.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Because they were real security people. They were real engineers. They were real analysts. They knew what they wanted. And they were using the product in such a way. So like without going too far into the weeds about how Tines works, but essentially it's an extremely unopinionated product. So think of it almost like Microsoft Excel for automation. So you can do absolutely anything that you want with it, right?
Okay.
Like it's almost like a basic set of carpentry tools. So you can like hang a door, install a window, build a table, whatever the hell you want to do. And so as a result, the product can be used in any way that these people want. So like when I was talking to these security teams in this bake-off, they'd be like, hey, you know, we want to go and we want to automate this particular process. And I'd be like, cool, well, you know, here's how I would imagine that you might want to do this. And I would go away and I'd come back in a week's time and I would see what they had built, what they had created with the product. And it was so thrilling to see the tools that I had constructed in my head and envisioned being used in a certain way, used in a completely different but equally effective way.
It must be such a buzz, yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, that thrill never goes away. Like we've got, you know, hundreds of customers now automating millions of things every single day. We've got 12,000 people using the free version of our product. And every single time I see somebody do something that I could never have imagined them doing, it's kind of like, oh my God, that's so amazing. That thrill never dilutes.
So what happened in summer? It was just you doing this bake-off?
Yep. It was just me doing this bake-off for this like enormous company. They're like a Fortune 10. So like, you know, 100,000 employees. And, you know, it was just me. We were bootstrapped and self-funded as well. So I would take like X amount of euros from like my savings account every month and put it into like the Tines like business account. And so eventually the way this bake-off was going to work was each product was going to be evaluated across the same three use cases. So they were going to say, hey, look, here's the three things that we want to automate. And we're going to attempt to build these three things in these three products. And because the way these things work, they tend to be like double blind. So you can't see what the other products are doing or how they're working.
Okay.
Because you have an unfair advantage.
Yeah.
So as one of these products, I was getting all this feedback and fixing all these bugs. And I was trying to, like, I was being quite honest about like the size of company that I was and stuff. But at the same time, I didn't want this Fortune 10 to think that like, we were complete amateurs.
Yeah.
No idea. So like,
yeah.
You know, it's
a fine line between honesty and not being too honest.
Yeah. Honesty and lying.
Rings through and is like, hello, Tines. Owen speaking.
Hold on,
I'll get Owen for you.
Owen speaking. Yeah. Let me just check with the engineer. Turns out
I'll patch it through to engineering.
Yeah. So anyway, there was these three things that each product was going to be evaluated on. And at the end of the process, the team that were evaluating Tines had actually implemented all three perfectly as described, including a bonus one. And I was like, that's pretty good. Like, this has got to put me in like prime position to win this deal.
Yeah.
And not only that, the other products hadn't even achieved a single one. So they actually hadn't implemented one in these other products.
Wow.
Not one. And so company decided, we're going to go with you guys. And I was like, fantastic. That's amazing. Thank you so much. And then like I learned that, you know, an enterprise procurement process is like a 6-month grueling process. And I'd be like redlining documents and trying to figure out how to like put my code in escrow and all these kind of like gnarly things that need to happen. But that company is still a happy customer today.
Wow.
Yeah.
What? It must have been like nearly the kiss of death though to kind of go, okay, now you've got to go from here to there on your own in the next few months.
Never felt like that.
Wow.
Never.
You were just like, right, go time.
Yeah. Yeah. I always felt like there was always more. Like, I was like, why is it only one? Like, how come it's not 50? Right.
Oh, amazing.
Okay. So there was never, like, for sure, there was times where I felt overwhelmed, but I also backed the product. I really believed in the product that we had built. And at that stage, if you treat everything as like this learning opportunity, it doesn't feel as if it's, the stakes are that high.
Okay.
Like, it's not like, hey, if this doesn't work, we're going to lose this, our only customer. It's right. Like, think of all the amazing things that I'm going to learn and how this is going to improve the product if this all falls flat in its face.
Amazing. So it's a perspective thing. You had the perspective of growth at all times.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. Okay. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah.
Okay. Magic. So yeah. What happened? What was next? Did you stay on your own? Did you try bake it yourself or did you hire people or what happened?
So a really good friend of mine and a former colleague, a guy called Thomas, he and I had worked together for like the best part of a decade in eBay and PayPal and DocuSign. Okay. And so I really wanted him to join Tines, but I also didn't want him to take any unnecessary risks that I had taken. So it was kind of like, I'd send him a little bit of an update, like, hey, here's how it's going. I think I'm going to get a customer fairly soon and okay. So on. And then eventually I convinced him to join. So he joined in February 2019. So kind of like a year later. Right. At that stage, I probably had like 3 or 4 customers.
Wow.
Was it
still just you?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep.
Wow.
Managing all the infrastructure, writing all the code, writing the blogs, managing the marketing side, doing customer support, doing customer success. Everything.
How did you balance that?
I just worked an extraordinary amount. Like, there's no other way to describe it.
I thought you were going to give me the secret sauce there.
No.
Just work really,
just
really,
worked really hard.
Really hard.
Just prioritization. Ruthless prioritization. I realized very early on, probably even before I founded the company, that the only thing that was going to make us successful was having deliriously happy customers. And so that is all I focused on. And it's still pretty much all we focus on today is just getting a set of customers who adore what we're doing and will tell their friends about it. And so when you have that framing, you tend not to focus on things that don't impact that goal, right? So like I didn't do podcasts, right? Like I didn't talk to venture capitalists. I didn't go and like fill out Enterprise Ireland forms. All I did was talk to these customers, build a product that would make them amazingly happy. And it has a very leveling effect. And like, you know, every morning you wake up, it's kind of like, well, what am I doing today that's going to make my customers happy? And if it's nothing, then you just don't do that thing.
Magic. I love that.
Yeah.
That is apps, because I think that's the hardest challenge as a founder. It's so distracting at times. Mm-hmm. People can, because you do get pulled in lots of different directions and shiny new things crop up all the time.
Yeah, totally.
So you kept that in front of mind always. How do I make my customers as happy as they can be?
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yep.
If it didn't move the needle in terms of happiness for customers, it wasn't getting done.
What didn't happen? Didn't happen.
Magic.
So like, you know, if it was a case of, and you come up against these like decisions like 100 times a day, like 100 times a day, mm-hmm. It's like, especially in those early stages, and even today where there's so much to do. There's so much to do. There's so much stuff that you could do that would add value, that would like make the product neater, that would like maybe increase the top of the funnel, maybe help with a deal, etc. So you come up against these decisions all the time. And if you just ask yourself, is this going to make a customer happy? Like, sure, like it'll be great if the typo on the blog was fixed. But like, is that more important than like, you know, replying to that email within 15 seconds from the customer? Like that's kind of how you have to weigh it up.
How do you keep that focus though on? How do you do that? Because that is easier said than done. And I love that kind of mentality. I think that's crucial. Every founder listening should just adopt that. But how do you keep that focus consistently? Because we're all human, things weighing up and down, but you seem like you're able to keep that focus. Just listening to you, you have that focus locked in. How do you keep that locked in?
It's your job. Like that is it. That is your job. And that is the single most important part of your job, is just having happy customers.
Mm.
Like, as a founder, like, get the product market fit and then just make your customers happy, and everything else takes care of itself. Like, I'm not joking. Everything else takes care of itself. It's easier to raise capital because you've got happy customers. It's easier to win other customers because you've got happy customers. It's easier to know what you need to build because your customers are happy telling you what they want. It's not like when you pick up your phone and say, hey, look, we're struggling right now about how we should develop this feature. Can I have 10 minutes? And they're like, absolutely. We love you guys. Yeah. So like, it's once you start to see the impact that happy customers have, it becomes a lot easier to focus on it. But like, if in those early days we didn't have happy customers, it would have been really easy not to focus on them.
Yeah.
But because it was the value that having those happy customers was so apparent made, it was like very easy to continue focusing on it.
So did Thomas come on board then?
Yep.
So one year later, he came on board, February 2019.
February 2019, we moved out of like our like 10 square foot office into like a 15 square foot office.
Really doubling
under,
up.
Yeah, under the Lewis. And all we did was just like churn through work. And he and I had like worked together for a decade. And so we had a really, really tight understanding of each other's strengths and weaknesses,
right,
and how to operate. And we would know what each other were thinking without it having to be said, and so on. And so we just continued to focus on our customers, build product, write code. But at this stage, we were like, our brand was starting to like, people were starting to like hear about us and so on. And we started to be approached by like VCs who wanted to invest in the company and so on. And again, we were so laser focused. We just said no to absolutely everything. And
you were revenue generating at this stage. All the deals had started to come through. Okay.
We were a profitable company at that stage. And you know, continuing to win those big bake-offs against like billion-dollar companies.
Mm.
But still like a two-person company with a product that we were like terribly embarrassed of.
That's wild. This is a wild story. I love it.
Yeah.
These are my favorites. So February, you started winning and momentum building behind you.
Yep.
At what stage then did you shift gears?
Probably when we raised like our first 15-ish million dollars.
What made you raise, I suppose, is a better question, because you were profitable.
Yeah.
The two of you probably had not a good work-life balance, but it was controllable. What made you raise?
We wanted to build a platform and a product that we were outrageously proud of. That was like generational. And to do that, you need more than two people working under a bridge in Dundrum. Literally, that's what we were doing. And so could we have continued to be bootstrapped and reinvesting our dollars into the company and hiring an engineer this year and two engineers next year? Absolutely. But we were also like impatient. We wanted to do it faster. And so the reason we raised when we did was because we'd reached a stage where we felt we had product market fit, right? Like we're doing several hundred thousand dollars in recurring revenue. We've got some incredible logos like Sophos, Auth0, Box, Coinbase, like all these big companies were using the product. Wow. And we felt like the time was right to kind of like double down on this thing and start going. And at that stage, you know, many VCs had reached out to us over the course of the last kind of 12 to 18 months. The spaces that we were operating in, which is like cybersecurity and automation, were probably like two of the hottest areas as well. And we were like right at the confluence of each. And, you know, we had some ravingly happy customers.
So people were starting to talk about you to other people going, these guys,
yeah,
check them out.
Yeah.
Heard about this? Heard about Tynes?
Yeah. Totally.
Magic.
Totally.
You weren't going out there. People were coming to you. I mean, the power dynamic there is huge.
Yeah. In our tiny little niche, right? So this wasn't like you'd go to a the supermarket and people would be talking about ties.
Oh my God, there's all.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. This is like a conference in Dublin where 15 people attend have heard of us.
It's all relative though.
Yeah,
it's
exactly,
all
relative. Exactly. But like, hey man, that's like, that's how you get started. So yeah, that's why we raised. And so when we raised, then we started to go about like just hiring the best people that we could work with.
Yeah.
And we initially focused very much on product people, right? Because that's where we felt that like we had the biggest gap. Even though I was still writing all the code, building all the product, et cetera, we needed some like professionals. And so we were able to hire both folks that we had worked with in the past in like large multinationals, and also people that like, you know, wanted to come work with us that we know through our network and so on and so forth. So we probably finished 2019. It was just me and Thomas. Actually, me and Thomas and another guy called Martin. So there was three of us in like December 2019. And then we had two more people who joined in early 2020. And so we were five people. We had just moved into a bigger office, our third office at this stage, in like January 2020. And then we shut the doors in like March 2020 for what we thought would be like 4 weeks or something like that. So we were five people when lockdown started. And we just continued to do what we were doing, focusing on the customer, building product that we were extremely proud of. And
what was it like as an extremely focused, like talking to you is a real insight into the mind of a founder, but what was it like as such a product focused founder to have to go, okay, I'm going over here now to raise this money. How did you balance that?
Some great advice that I read many, many years ago. Do you know a guy called Rand Fishkin? He founded SEO Moz.
Yeah.
So he founded SEO Moz. He wrote a book called like Lost and Founder. And one of the things he says in this book is the worst thing you can do is found a company to do what you love. Like, do not found a company to do what you love, because the reality is you're not going to get to do it. Right. Because like this is my analogy, but let's say you're a mechanic and your favorite thing in the world is to fix cars. Like that's what you love doing. The worst thing you can do is like start a garage, right? Because you're going to be dealing with like irate customers, ordering parts, tax returns, VAT,
admin.
Rent, all that stuff. You're probably never going to like put your hands on tools. The only reason that you should start a company or build a product or service or something is if you genuinely believe that the world can work in a different way. If that is truly something that you believe, and it can be something as seemingly modest as, I just think there's a better ways that we can fix cars in Dublin 16, right? Like that can be your genuine belief. And then start a garage. Because if you really believe that, then you can start a garage. And so then it won't matter if you're like changing tires or dealing with tax returns or getting chewed out of it by a customer, right? Like it doesn't matter, because it's always in service of this vision that you have for how the world can work differently. And so when I founded Tynes, I wasn't founding the company to go and build a product, right? Like that's not what I thought. That was a big part of my job in the early days. But I was founding a company because I genuinely believe that there's a better way for companies to operate, right? Today, all these companies have access to all these different tools and are absolutely bogged down with repetitive manual processes. So my belief is that there is a better way for these teams to work. That if you give easy to use, understandable, robust, powerful tools that allows frontline workers automate the repetitive manual tasks, that companies will do better, people will have happier jobs, and innovation will like bloom, right? I genuinely believe that. And so for me, it didn't matter if I was building a product, talking to a customer, raising capital, hiring somebody, firing somebody, speaking on a podcast. It's always been in service of that vision. If that makes sense.
It makes incredible sense. Yeah, it makes beautiful sense. How did you find that as a product guy though? When you stepped out into the new world of VC, was that something natural to you? Had you raised before, or how did you find that?
Had never raised before. You know, I had been in VC, I'd worked in VC backed companies, and I knew the names of like tier one VCs like Excel and Index and Sequoia and A16Z and things like that. But that was like the height of my knowledge.
Okay.
How did I find it? It was just another thing that needed to be done, like honestly. And like we trusted our instincts when it was happening. You know, we started with a raise of about $15 million for our Series A in 2019. So we raised $15 million from like firms called Blossom, who are a boutique firm in London. They were at the first money in times. And then we raised like an additional kind of like 11-ish million from Index Ventures, who are like Datadog and Uber and Revolut and companies like that, and Excel, who are like Facebook Series A and CrowdStrike.
Huge names.
Massive, yeah. Tier 1 VCs. Yep, yep.
No messing around.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But like at the same time, we were never intimidated by it. Like we were never intimidated, but I do distinctly remember there's all these weird things that happen when you're at that phase, right? So we had a free AIB startup bank account, right? Like that's just something I needed to like lodge a check from a customer. So I went to the bank one morning and opened an account, like 15-minute job, didn't think anything else about it. And then we were going through like our lawyers and we were like finalizing the documentation for this. And then like one of the last things came, I was like, so where do you want us to send this like $15 million? And I was like, oh, we've got a bank account. And they were like, This is like an AIB startup account that they give to like students, man. Like you can't send 15 minutes.
AIB head office fraud alarm. It's just like beep and go, oh my God, something's happening on College Green, quick.
Yeah, totally. So like I remember ringing up like the bank manager in AIB and he's like, hey, look, man, I'm going to.
This is going to sound weird, but.
Yeah, I'm going to be receiving like $50 million like tomorrow. Is that going to be a problem? And the dude's like, what? So it's like all this kind of like weird stuff happens. But then, you know, we were just operating at a different level. The expectations were much higher. Yeah. You know, our names were in the newspaper, all that kind of like stuff was going on around the same time. But again, we still just stayed laser focused on writing code, taking feedback, iterating and making our customers successful. That's all we did.
And then what happened with you guys in COVID? Because it just seemed to accelerate you. Instead of impacting you, it seemed to accelerate you even further.
Yeah, it's really hard to say, and I think about this a lot, it's really hard to say if COVID was the accelerant, if the $15 million bank in the account was the accelerant, if...
It's rarely one thing, right?
Yeah.
It's usually this confluence of time.
Oh, totally. And like, I think another thing that you learn as a founder is that like, you're constantly thinking that the next milestone is what's going to like step change your growth. Like you're constantly like, okay, for you, it's like video. That's it. We're going to do it. It's video. It's like, oh yeah, man, TikTok. That's what's really going to take this through the roof. Or it's like, we're going to do a podcast in New York. Then we'll take off. Yeah. And the reality is, it's like, you look at the growth numbers and it's just like, oh man, that just went up like 5%. Oh, that's, fuck. I really thought it was going to be more than that. And then you take like two steps back or you look back across 3 years and it turns out those 5% every single month compound and you're like, oh wow, like take with a wide lens, this is actually great. And so it's not these like one-off overnight things, it's just that constant grind. So
the compounding.
Absolutely. So in March 2020 we were five people. We closed our doors on our office in RapMinds and grew to about kind of like 17 people at the end of that year, and then finished up the following year at like about 100 people, I think, and then like 160 people today. I think the one thing I will say that certainly was an advantage for us in COVID was, one, our ICP customers, so our ideal customers who are like late stage technology companies, like our customers are folks like DocuSign and Elastic and GitLab and folks like that. They were making hay during COVID, right? And so they had capital that they could invest in technologies. So that helped for sure. But also it was a great leveler for us selling into these companies. Because like most of these companies that we sell are like something like 95% of our revenue is coming out of the US. And we were selling to all these people from Dublin. And so our competitors had an advantage because they had sales reps on the road in the Bay Area and Dallas and Pacific Northwest. And all of a sudden it was irrelevant because all of a sudden then it was like, okay, well, how good is the product? It's a bake-off now between how good your demo looks over Zoom and how good a pilot you can run. And being local has no impact on either of those.
That is so interesting.
Yeah.
Like that is just one of those insights that come out of COVID where you're like, okay, mind blown. That shifted the frame forever.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. And we still see it today. Like we'll be talking to customers today and we'll be on a Zoom and we'll be doing a demo, and it's like 10 people with 10 completely different backgrounds. Like, they're all over the place. Whereas, and it's easier to schedule those demos, and it's easier to do follow-ups. And, you know, we have got the best product in our space. And so we have an unfair advantage now, because all of a sudden people just want to cut straight to the chase. Show me your product on like a Zoom screen share. It's none of this like, hey, I'll take you out for dinner and buy you beers and like,
yeah,
to the Super Bowl or whatever it is. Like, that just is irrelevant now.
Let's go to the best. Get the best. Just go to the best, get the best. Done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think that's going to stay? Is business going to stay like that in certain sectors, I think?
I think there will be a degree of like swing back inevitably. But I do think the best product will continue to win. Like, I think the buying behaviors of customers was naturally changing already, but has just been accelerated. Whereas, like, you know, previously there was a lot of top-down selling going on, especially in aerospace, where the CEO of a billion-dollar security company will take out the like CEO of the customer and like buy them with wine, and that'll be all pushed down. As whereas nowadays, it's kind of like, hey, you know, we're already using this product at a ground level. Customers are our users love it, and they're going to like sponsor us to buy it.
Product-led marketing is just something that's bubbling up. I hadn't, if I'm honest, I hadn't heard about it until about 2 years ago. Mm. I was naive to it. I was like, I was doing it. I was using Notion. I was using all these different document products. Yeah. But it was only when a couple of founders were like, oh, we're taking a product-led marketing approach. I was like, makes sense. Seed into companies, for lots of companies, it does. Bottom right.
Like, for lots of company, like product-led growth and product-led marketing make like a ton of sense. But for other companies, it doesn't. Like, I think there's a real danger that people will see the trend and assume it's for them.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And it's just like, oh, you know.
The silver bullet.
Applies. Yeah, like Zoom. Oh my God, like Zoom is crushing it on like PLG, or Datadog is nailing it on PLG. Mm. And it turns out you're like very different to that. You require a ton of handholding. Your product like needs an 8-week deal cycle, and your average deal size is going to be like $1 million. PLG is not for you.
Yeah.
Like, it's not. And so you need to know what's right for you and right for your customers. And the way you do that is by talking to customers, right? Like,
how did you evolve from the product guy, the coder, into being a CEO of a company with this many people? I don't mean how did it happen. I mean, you just grew into it. But for you, what's that been like, personally?
It's, if you had told me at the start, actually, let me tell you. So like February 1st, 2018, my first day of Tynes, I got up at like 7 o'clock to go into the office. I was like so excited, couldn't wait to get started, was dying to get going. In the back of my head, genuinely, I was thinking, you know, I'll probably grow this thing to like 20 people, and that's when I'm going to tap out. Like, that's when I'll start to like lose the passion that I have for like the product. Today, I get up at 6 a.m., man. I get up at 6 a.m. because I'm just even hungrier than I ever was. And I think it's been surprising to me how much I've enjoyed going from somebody who's writing code 12 hours a day to somebody who is setting core values and defining mission statements and doing executive alignment sales calls. Like, if you had told me, hey man, you know, in 2023, that's what you're going to be doing, I would have been like, I'm absolutely not starting this company.
That's not me.
I'm not doing that. But again, it's always been in service of this like mission, and I've really loved it. And you know, I still fundamentally believe that I'm the right person for the job. Like, I'm not someone who's so egotistical that thinks I will be the right person for this job forever. I don't think I will be. Like, I think there's a stage where I'm maybe not the right person to be CEO. Like, that could be 50 years from now. It could be like 5 years from now. It's hard to say. Mm. But for now, I like love my job. I think I'm doing an okay job at it. And you know, as a result, I've just enjoyed the transition. It's been surprising. Mm.
You raised 15, and then you started to grow and grow and grow. At what stage did you think, okay, we need to go again?
We need to grow. In terms of like raising capital?
Yeah.
So every time we've raised capital, we've been very fortunate that we've never needed to. Like, so we had never built a pitch deck. We had never proactively gone and spoken to VCs. And I know that's like an extremely privileged thing to be able to say, but that was just our reality. Like, that was just the way it was working out for us. And so when we did our Series B, which was in the, last year, 2021, which was kind of like March, April 2021, we had no intention of like raising that year. I distinctly remember being in like an executive meeting and being like, okay, let's have some non-goals here for this year. Like, we're not going to raise. We're just not going to do
non-goals. And, I love that.
And then like, you know, 3 months later, it's kind of like, hey, everybody, I'm just on the term sheet.
I'm just editing the Notion doc to say our goals are now to raise.
What are you talking about?
I never said that was a non-goal. So, you know, we never felt the need to do it. It was always been like, hey, can you raise? Can it be a lightweight process? Is it a good investor? Is it going to move the needle? Is it increase the valuation? Then do it.
Mm. Right. And what was that raise for?
How do you mean?
Money-wise.
Oh, money-wise, I think that was like 26 million or something like that.
Okay.
So in total, we've raised something like 98. Like the guts of $100 million over the course of the last couple of years.
That is mind-blowing. As an Irish company started in 2018, that is something that should be celebrated. And I know for you it's not, but I just think we have to mark that here and go, look, this is something to really look at and go, this is happening in Dublin right now.
Maybe not right now. maybe not in like Q1 2023.
But different world now, but it is happening. You're building this company out, and we always look to San Fran, we always look to America for like all these companies that are getting built out. Oh my God, imagine. And we talked about this briefly over lunch, you know, the FDI versus the Irish ecosystem. Like, there's something special happening in Ireland and in Dublin right now to see companies like yourself being built. Why do you think that is?
I think, again, I don't think it's a single thing that you can point to and be like, this is the reason. Yeah. I think it's like a combination of a few things. I think one is people are just, at least for me, it's just like, why can't I do this? Like, why shouldn't I be able to like raise $100 million from Dublin? Why shouldn't we be able to build this entire product from Dublin? Why shouldn't we be able to like beat a $100 billion company in a bake-off? Why can't we do that? And so I think there's just this general like willingness to ask that question now rather than just like take it for gospel from the get-go. I distinctly remember like when we were doing our Series A and we were raising like $15 million or something like that, and I was speaking to an Irish VC who's now like a friend of mine I know really well, and he was just like, and you think you'll be able to like hire the sales and marketing talent that you need in Dublin? And I was just like, why the fuck can't I? Like, why not? Like, I just think like it hasn't always been possible.
No.
Don't get me wrong. Like, I'm not saying that this is like Stripe had to be in San Francisco or that like Intercom had to have like their CEO in San Francisco. At that stage, they absolutely did. But I think for us, we didn't have to.
There is a shift. I think that's why I asked this question. I think there is a shift that there is now a new way of working, and Dublin can capitalize on that, and Irish entrepreneurs can build and stay here.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the part of the reason that people would have been doing this is, you know, one of the great rationales that you were given for like why you needed to like have a Delaware C company rather than the Irish limited company, and why you needed to be in San Francisco was it's going to be really hard to raise capital. Like, that was one of the main reasons that people would say you had to be like elsewhere, because your Excels and Sequoias and A16Zs are just not going to invest in an Irish company. They're just not. And so we didn't, like, that was never our intention. So like, we were like, well, I don't give a shit if like Excel won't invest in an Irish company, because like, that's not part of the plan. And so we never had this idea that this is something that we would like have to do. And as a result, we were like, what's going to be the easiest, quickest thing to do that's going to allow us to get back to focusing on our customers? And for us, that was like pay 50 quid to the CRO to have an Irish limited company called Tyne Security Services, right? It's like, that's going to be so quick, so easy. And then I can go back to like fixing this bug for our customer.
The customer. Back to the customer. I love that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Was there a moment, like, you seem like such a driven dude. Was there a moment that you're just kind of going, holy shit, what's going on? what have I done?
That happens all the time.
Are you still so much in it that you're like, why shouldn't I?
No, I think like, another piece of advice I got early on was from the founder of a company called MuleSoft, a guy called Ross Mason. And he has this thing where he's like, look, up until 20 people, culture is irrelevant. Like, their culture is not important in your company because you're going to be involved in every single decision that's being made. You literally can't. You can be involved in every decision from like the type of coffee that you buy for the coffee machines to the length of a POC to the price that you're going to charge a customer. You can be involved in every single one of those things. After 20 people, culture is all that matters because there's going to be decisions being made absolutely everywhere in your organization. And you're not going to be able to control those decisions that are being made. And so when I see a decision made in the organization somewhere where I'm just like, oh my God, like, what are we doing? That's a failure in our culture.
Okay.
That has been a failure in our culture because for whatever reason, that decision was made, which is like in stark contrast to like some cultural values that we have, which is like focus on the customer. Mm. Or our values are speed, simplicity, and soundness. So like if there's decisions being made that are...
I love that.
Thank you. If there's decisions being made in contrast to that, then like we need to look in the mirror rather than looking out the window.
Yeah, one of my mottos is, we say it on the pod all the time, is just be sound.
Yeah, yeah.
Just be sound. I said to my wife yesterday, I was like, it's amazing how just being sound people just works. You can overthink things, you can have all the strategies you want, you can be the smartest guy in the room, but if you're not sound, it'll, you know, you'll get by for a while.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Just being sound
100%
will get you a long way in life. Yeah. I heard someone describe that as the one room problem.
Oh, yeah.
When you have one room,
yeah.
Everyone knows what's going on. I can hear Owen on a call. I can, by osmosis, understand what's going on.
Yeah.
He's like, the minute we went to another room, and he goes, the next room was literally next door.
Yeah.
He goes, but it was his life. It was as if we'd moved to a different country.
Yeah.
It was number two room, didn't know what number one room was doing.
Yep.
And it caused a huge rift in the company.
Yeah.
How do you build a culture? You've built it in an extremely unusual way in the fact that you've gone from 5 to 160 remotely.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think the most important thing is you hire the right people and get out of their way. And if you hire the wrong people, you try and get them out as quickly as you can. And it becomes like a self-governing problem then, where like you set the tone from the top and you lead by example, and then you hope that you've hired the right people who will also do the right things. And I think that's once you do that, like it kind of becomes a self-fulfilling thing. Mm. The hard part, of course, is like hiring those right people and then identifying when you've hired the wrong people and like kind of correcting those decisions.
Especially when it's remote, right? I would imagine, I don't know, but yeah. I would imagine it's much more difficult because, you know, it's me and you sitting down here, I'm getting to know you. We just had lunch. I'm getting to know you. You know, there's an interaction there. Over Skype and Zoom, how do you do that?
Like, I think we overstate how hard it is sometimes. Like, you can read a lot into someone's personality, their values, their priorities, the way they want to work, how they treat their colleagues, just by how they like answer Slack messages. Like you don't necessarily need to be like sitting beside someone 9 to 5 to be able to tell, oh shit, like we got this one wrong.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like
fascinating.
And you just know deep in your gut as well, where it's just like, oh man, that was a really shitty thing to say in Slack or whatever. Right. Or like, man, like, what is that person doing rolling their eyes on like Zoom or something like that? And they're just like trivial examples. But I think
the small things are the big things, right?
Yeah. They're really good indicators where it's just kind of like, okay, that was a little bit unusual. I'll pay a bit of attention like next time. And like, then you begin to like accumulate enough intelligence and knowledge to be able to say, okay, yeah, we got this one wrong. Or we're not in a position to make this person successful. Or actually, we have this person in the complete wrong role.
How have you learned how to grow such a phenomenal company so quickly? Like, what's been the process? I know you focus just on the customer, everything to serve the customer. But I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that comes with it.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of stuff that comes with it. I think, like, it'd be a complete fabrication for me to say that I do it all. Like, I really don't. Like, we've now got a team of incredibly talented, more talented than me, smarter than me, more motivated than me in many ways, people in the team who are way better at their jobs than I am. But I can like rely on them and I trust them to go and like solve problems that I could never solve. So it's not a case of like I'm the person who's like winning all these customers and building all this product. I absolutely am it. There's people who are way more important in the company than I am. And it just like what I think we do well is we just hire really, really great people and we motivate them and we give them a shared purpose and tons of autonomy and let them get on with what they do best.
Speed, simplicity and soundness. The minute you said that, I'm like, I have a clear idea of what they're looking for. What do you look for in people? Outside those three things, what do you look for as a founder? You're like, yes, that's an immediate hire.
I think there's rarely a point where I'm just like, this is the person for us. Like, unless, you know, there's something really specific that I'm taking on with this person. Okay?
Yeah.
I think like you need to spend a little bit of time with the person and both avoid your like natural recency bias, which is like, oh yeah, that person was amazing. We should definitely hire that person because that'll come back and bite you.
They always say that. Be the first interview or the last interview. Yeah. Don't be in the middle.
Yeah. So I think, I think the kind of folks that have really worked out for us in times, but also in like my careers previously when I hired a bunch of people as well, was hiring people that really care, not just about like their own work, but about other people's and about the customers and like just have a level of empathy that's uncommon. Like that, I think, is a really good indicator. People who are really willing to work hard. And I don't mean like do 18 hours a day work, but like put in a shift, like
on the right things.
Yeah, totally. And then I think if you have that, the rest, you can teach the rest. You can teach someone how to do sales. You can teach someone to write code. You can teach someone the particular technology stack that you have. But once you have those core ingredients and, you know, they're indicating that they'd be a good fit for our culture in that they have a bias for speed and they like to keep things simple and they move fast, then we find that they're usually pretty good hire.
What excites you now?
Now?
Yeah.
Oh, man. So when I founded Tynes, I knew that we could solve the challenges that were facing security teams. Right? Like if you think about what Tynes does, it allowed security teams to automate all the repetitive workloads, right? I knew that I could do that. I'd seen the problems firsthand and I knew that I could build a product that would satisfy it. What was always going on in the back of my mind was the two problems that we were solving in security were too much work and not enough staff, right? Like they were the big problems that we were solving. There's just like way too many tools, too much data. It's too hard to hire these people and train them and retain them. They're the two problems. Those two problems exist everywhere in the enterprise, right? They exist in HR, there's too much work and not enough staff. They exist in marketing and recruiting and engineering and infrastructure and IT and DevOps and so on. And so the way we've always built the product has always been, let's absolutely solve the problems of security teams, but let's do it in such a way that eventually, if things are looking good and if our customers are amenable to it and it makes sense, that we could also solve those two problems for other teams, right? So like the product that we're building today, if you squint at it, there's very little security specific to it. And so we're already seeing a bunch of our customers use the product outside security, like in areas like IT onboarding and HR and places like that. So what gets me really, really, really excited is creating a brand new category of software, right? One that creates this enterprise-wide automation layer that allows anybody, regardless of their technical background, regardless of the technology stack, regardless of their tooling, allows them to automate their own repetitive workflows, freeing them up to focus on things that make them happy. Whether that's like interviewing people or whether that's like going and hanging out with like colleagues, whatever it is, just get them off the mundane, monotonous, error-prone stuff. And that's what we're planning to do for the next few years.
Magic. You see that with AI, everyone's panicking and freaking out. Going, oh, it's going to lead to mass jobs, mass. And I'm like, no, it's going to make things better.
I think there's a load of different takes you can have. Like my take is that, and this is also like our head of product thinks this, that like the galaxy brain take here is that like AI is definitely going to take some jobs, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's going to create way more jobs, but also those jobs are going to be way harder. Mm-hmm. Like it's actually going to be like harder work because it's no longer take this file, drag it into this folder, attach it to the email, yeah, and press send. Because like that work is disappearing. right? And so your job is going to be way more creative and it's going to be way more
fulfilling, I would imagine. I think it'll challenge people. I don't think it's a net negative. I think it'll just evolve.
Yeah.
There's always evolution. Humans are the strangest creatures in the world. We want two things. We want everything to stay the same and we want progress.
Yeah.
And we want them simultaneously.
Yeah.
And we freak out when something changes, but equally we're like, oh, wouldn't it be great when this happens? You're like, everything changes.
Yep.
But it changes for the better if you adopt
the
growth mindset.
Just change.
That's it, right?
Yeah.
How do you switch off? Do you switch off?
I try to. Like, I love my job, right? So it's not...
I can tell the energy and the love. Like, it's like we could chat about this all day and I feel it wouldn't be one of those conversations where someone's just here just talking about their company.
Yeah.
You can clearly tell the passion. But how do you, like, outside of that... How are you able, you probably aren't, but how are you able to kind of like balance, get to balance, or is it balance?
I do a decent amount of running. I've got a amazing family that I love to spend time with. I've got great friends who like critically aren't involved in this world.
It's key.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I love thinking about work. Like it's not something where I'm like, I want to go home and like shut my laptop and just be like, oh, thank God I'm done with that.
Yeah.
Like, I'll happily like wake up a few minutes early and just like think about something. Or when I go for a run, I'm usually thinking about work stuff. So I don't feel, and this isn't for everybody by any stretch of imagination, but I don't necessarily feel the need to like switch off unless it's a case of, hey, I actually need to unplug for the benefit of the company to go and like recharge or something like that.
Sometimes it's important, right? It's you can't be all on all the time. What is the, I even feel ridiculous asking you this considering what's happened since 2018. What does the next kind of like 12 to 24 months hold for Times and yourself?
I think we're in a really, really interesting period in like tech, right? And so this to me feels like way scarier than COVID felt, right? Like I think we're for the first time ever, we're entering a period where I'm like, oh man, this is, I actually can't see what's happening in the next like 12 to 18 months in terms of like the macro environment.
Yeah.
I think we're extremely fortunate where we are and the kind of software that we provide in that our main value prop is we help people do more with less. And so like heading into like a bit of a decline, a contraction, you could argue that actually we're well positioned to thrive through these next like 12 to 18 months. We are very, very fortunate in that we have like a very healthy balance sheet. So we don't need to worry about like raising capital. We don't need to worry about anything like that. The valuation that we have raised at is means that like our employees who are coming on board are not going to be underwater. So it's much easier to attract great talent. I think what'll be, if we come out of the next 12 to 18 months having... For the last 3 years, we've tripled revenue for the last 3 years, every year for the last 3 years. I think what we would love to do is continue on a similar trajectory, but also build a product that allows us cross that chasm into like more enterprise services.
Okay. What's the end goal?
To build a generational company. Genuinely, I think I truly mean this. I don't have like an exit strategy. I think a lot of founders make that mistake by like, hey, we're going to go and we're going to build this company and like get it ready for sale, or we're going to try and build a company and get it ready for IPO. I think the best thing you can do is like build a company that makes your customers absolutely delirious. Do it in a way that you're building a product that you're really proud of, and then give yourself the optionality to figure out what makes sense when the time is right. That's really what we're trying to do, is just like, hey, get to $1 million in recurring revenue, or sorry, $100 million in recurring revenue, and like the rest will take care of itself.
Seems pretty logical to me.
Simple, right?
I'm on board. I'm drinking the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
Oh, is there a book that's kind of made an impact on you personally or professionally?
Would you believe I actually read a lot of poetry?
Okay. Didn't expect us to go there. Let's go.
So my favorite poet is a dude called Ted Kooser. He was a like poet laureate for like the US like relatively recently, but he's an older guy who like lectures at like the University of Nebraska or somewhere like that. And his style is extraordinarily approachable. So like, you know, like people who read poetry think of like Wordsworth and...
I'm having Leaving Cert flashbacks.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, right? And it's like, oh my God, I have no idea like what the hell this person is talking about. Yeah. Like, and there's all these like couplets and like sonnets and all this like complexity, whereas like someone like Kuzer or Anis Mojani or like somebody like that, they write in an extraordinarily approachable way. And it, what it does is it kind of like, it makes you think about like the impact you can have with such a small amount of like material, right? So like, hey, like this 10 line poem is going to fucking blow your head off, like blow your head off. And
I can draw the straight line to Tynes here. Yeah.
Right. Like, so I love the medium for a start, but I also just love that the care and attention that goes into like crafting this thing, which seems on the face, but like, oh man, that probably took like, what, 10 minutes to write that thing? But like, nah, that took like a year.
A lifetime. Yeah.
Totally. This is like, it's the same like Oscar Wilde's famous quote, which is something along the lines of somebody asked him, hey, how was your day? And he was like, oh, it was great. I spent all day. I took a comma out and then I put it back in. I was like, that was his day. It's like, that is the level of craft and care that goes into something which seems, you know, fairly like throwawayable at the end.
But in modern world, I think, where everything is so disposable and there's so much noise and there's so much kind of chaos, I think to have care and craftsmanship over anything, no matter what it is, but taking that pride is beautiful.
Yeah, it's timeless.
Where can people learn more about Tynes?
Tynes.com, TINES.com. I'm on Twitter. I'm on like LinkedIn. We're pretty easy to find.
Beautiful. Owen, that was honestly an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.